those strategies is use of community health workers and doulas and traditional health workers. So how can they be used? Through chronic disease self-management, community programs, corrections, and also within clinical settings. There are a number of models currently that are being implemented, including through HealthShare and through Kaiser, where community health worker models are actually starting to be developed. But there's still more work that's needed, especially within the city of Portland. Another recommendation is establishing and monitoring performance metrics related to health equity outcomes for planning and neighborhood involvement, transportation, housing, and parks. Also like to promote access to mental health and addiction services in the city of Portland's housing sites through expanded partnerships between Portland Police Bureau and county service providers. And again, this goes back to the community mental health strategies, including peer support specialists that can work in addictions and recovery communities. And I think Miracles Club is a great example of that. Peer wellness specialists working with folks with mental illness. And also you can see those examples in places like Central City Concern who actually have peer support specialists. How can they be utilized? Again, these folks can do things like administering naloxone, which prevents death through overdose. You can also treat folks who are with bipolar disorder and working directly with them as a support person, going on walks with them, helping them accomplish some of their goals in life, but also assessing their mental wellness regularly. And that's the kind of thing that community-based mental health providers can provide. Next on the recommendations, we'd like to reinforce policies that restrict disproportionate exposure to the marketing of tobacco products, alcohol, and unhealthy foods in low-income communities, especially in African-American neighborhoods. In the last few years, I think one of the greatest examples of working towards this is the culturally specific program based out of Multnomah County as the Achieve Initiative. Is a health equity initiative dedicated to addressing issues of healthy food, access to and marketing of tobacco products, but also promoting healthy foods within corner stores that are, that are serving things like halal food and, small corner stores that, people in our community go to on a regular basis. So those are some examples of strategies that we can use to limit the exposure to unhealthy foods.
Can I pick up on that point for a second? One of the things we did a few years ago is we kicked the junk food out of our rec centers, which in lots of other cities has been a fight because of the contracts with certain vendors and the contracts with soda companies. What we found was Nancy Becker crafted the plan, so she brought in a new set of standards. What we found is that with the captive audience, we sold just as much food, but it was healthy food, not the junk food. So the rec centers no longer look like you're at a Regal movie theater with, at the children's eye level, just candy and sodas. You replace it with healthy food and healthy choices, you get the same return. So it was a really important insight, I think. And then in terms of what you talked about, the corner store, I put a budget ask in this budget, as I did last year, to continue to fund the Village Market in the New Columbia, which for a lot of people in that, the most diverse census tract in the state, is the only accessible food. And the struggle they have and the reason they keep asking for subsidies is because they don't sell alcohol, tobacco, or lottery tickets. And that's the lifeblood of a corner store. And there's something wrong with a market model that says you have to sell that stuff in order to stay in business. That healthy food alone is not sufficient. So I appreciate your point.
Thank you. And we're in total agreement. I think the city has also done a great job in terms of promoting community gardens throughout the Portland area. The Urban League actually launched a community garden. The Delta Sigma Theta sorority launched a community garden. And there's a number of other community organizations that want to start community gardens. But again, if you put the options of healthy food and candy in front of kids, you know, they're more often going to be inclined to go for the foods with substance and the foods that taste good. And good food options just aren't accessible a lot of times for young families. Going to the determinants, promoting determinants of African-American health, again, addressing racism, which is an underlying contributor to health inequities and premature death. So again, this has been researched time and time again. The film Unnatural Causes is a great resource to learn more about how racism impacts your health. Supporting programs to reduce African Americans' poverty and increasing access to wealth. Supporting African Americans' access to healthy housing and neighborhood stability. Supporting environmental justice-oriented work to reduce disproportionate exposure to hazards. And ensuring access to transit and parks and recreation opportunities. And I think we already said this, but just to repeat, repealing the no-cause eviction laws. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Go on to the justice section. That's right.
No, I think you're fine.
Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Emmanuel Price. I am the director of SCAPE. SCAPE is a nonprofit organization I founded a few years ago, and it's an acronym. It's S-C-A-F-E, and it means second chances are for everyone. And what we do is we're not reinventing the wheel with Reentry Center. We're just adding a little bit more lubrication to it so it moves pretty smoothly to support other programs like Clean Slate, Better People, Mercy Corps. And I'll just talk a little bit about the criminal justice system and how it affects juveniles and African Americans and people of color. All right, so African Americans have long been active on issues of bias and criminal justice, but the issue was raised to the level of statewide attention in 1994. The Supreme Court of Oregon's audit of racial bias, it concluded that people of color are more likely to be arrested, charged, and convicted and incarcerated, and less likely to be released on bail or put on probation. There's a lengthy history in Portland that treat people differently by race. Portland's controversial drug-free zones were used from 1992 to 97 to ban people from neighborhoods on just based on a suspicion, not if they were convicted of drug possession or selling drugs, but just based on the suspicion alone. Eventually, they did away with this practice, and it was terminated because more African Americans were highly affected compared to their white counterparts. And the justice system is the title of this, and it says, a 2000 analysis of patterns of arrest, prosecution, sentencing, and supervision in Multnomah County revealed overrepresentation of racial and ethnic minorities permeated most crime categories. Then I'll skip down to the next paragraph. African Americans had the highest degree of overrepresentation in arrests for drug crimes, but were also disproportionately represented in other categories as well. While African Americans made up less than 10% of the population of Multnomah County, they accounted for roughly 22% of the Justice Department active adult caseload. And at that time, African Americans in the county were over three times more likely to be represented in the justice system than they were represented in the population of the city as a whole or the county. In addition, disparity existed in terms of supervision. In Multnomah County, in 2009, black non-Hispanic adults made up 5.2% of the population and 24% of the population under supervision. White and non-Hispanic adults made up 73% of the population and 64% of the population under supervision. Black adults make up, again, some of the same statistics. Black adults make up 27% under supervision population of Multnomah County, but only 5% of population are more likely to be police charged and sentenced. And it's true, like we have a small population of people in Oregon, but we have high numbers of people who are incarcerated that, you know, are African American and or are youth. And because of that, House Bill 3194, which I'll briefly kind of talk about, is just flatlining the prison growth over the next 5 years, saving $300 million. And that also helps reinvest into programs like other nonprofits or new emerging nonprofits to make sure that we can help reduce recidivism by providing those skill sets and those training tools that men and women who are coming out of incarceration can use to become successful in society. African-American youth are overrepresented in the juvenile justice system and are more likely to be given custodial sentences. African-American youth charge under Measure 11 enter the adult system. And African-Americans are 11% of the population, but 45% of the Measure 11 indictments. Again, we're a small number, but we have high numbers of incarceration or indictments when it comes to criminal behavior. The next slide is, it just kind of shows some of the disparities. And the ones I'm going to focus on is the first one all the way to the left, which is when folks are being charged, and then the last one all the way to the right when people are being committed. And as you can see, 3% of white folks are being charged, and roughly 19% of African Americans are being charged as well. So we're double and triple in these areas as far as being convicted and charged. And if you go all the way over to the right, being committed is also receiving a sentence and doing time and so on and so forth. And compared to white people, black people are 24%, and the percentage for white people is 10%. So not only are we being doubled and tripled and being charged and sometimes targeted unfairly, but we're also experiencing longer sentences, being removed from our communities, removed from our families. And when we come back to our families and our communities, they're not all the time representative of us as far as gentrification. People who may get released come back to the community. It doesn't look like it was before they left, and they come back and they feel out of place. They go to find work, and there's not a lot of employers that are willing to hire based on that background alone. And it's not like men and women don't want to work, but it's just they also need that second chance and that opportunity.
Can I ask you a question on that? And sure. It may be a question for Ann. But the data that you just showed in that chart presumably covers both violent and nonviolent crimes. And in light of what the president said recently about sentencing disparities around certain nonviolent crimes that disproportionately impact the African-American community, is it possible to disaggregate the data and separate out the violent and nonviolent and then do a filter for the impact of onerous drug laws as a contributor to the disparity?
It certainly would be possible.
We'll follow up on that.
So let me just make sure that I'm understanding that a black person and a white person do this, have the same behavior. The black person is more likely to be charged for that behavior, more likely to be detained, and then more likely to get a disproportionate sentence compared where the only difference is the color of the skin.
Exactly. And sometimes maybe white folks may actually get a probation, or they may have a diversion program. Whether black youth or black adults, they're going straight upstream. There's no deals. There's no drug rehabilitation. It's either yes or no, and that's just how it's been played out over the years. Just the next slide is reducing recidivism. Reducing recidivism is access to housing, health care, and employment. And after this slide, we're going to talk about some of the policy recommendations, but having affordable opportunities for people who have felony backgrounds, whether you're a man or a woman, making sure that if there is a way to create some type of intern and apprenticeship programs, a lot of men and women who are locked up, a lot of the work they do is food service, laundry, warehouse, type of labor jobs. So for them to get out and kind of continue the work that they've already done, helps them become productive members of society. They're able to earn their own money, pay fines, and kind of be a productive member of their family. Ideas such as a construction apprenticeship program or a plumbing apprenticeship program, I don't know what that would look like exactly, but I think it would be pretty sweet if once those people are released, maybe the city of Portland or Monoma County could set up a program to where they could go through this program and actually have a place to work after they've completed so many hours or so many requirements, whether it's plumbing or being an electrician and so on and so forth. Also, housing resources is very big. The three biggest factors of people being released are employment, housing, and health care. And you cannot get housing without employment. You can't get health care without employment. But oftentimes, when people are filling out job applications and trying to work, it gets down to that box that says, do you have a felony? They check that, automatically disqualified, before they even get to the meat of what their resume is and what their experience is. Also, possibly thinking about doing micro-pilot programs or micro-business pilot programs to where we can empower individuals to start their own food cart, for example, or invest in them to be entrepreneurs and putting monies in organizations where they help people get out and develop a sense of entrepreneurship and walk them through the classes, whether it's a lawn service or whether it's a food cart or whether it's just opening up a salon to cut hair and do hair. There's several variables. These are just some off the top of my head. Also, the service industry, again, a lot of people who are incarcerated, they do a lot of food service work, warehouse, laundry. So making sure that we could pick up on the skill sets that they already have and set up some type of program or apprenticeship to where they can get out and kind of just get grandfathered right into it and kind of do what they know how to do. But not limit them to that, but also encourage them to, you know, think beyond what they're already doing.
Before you move on healthcare, has there been specific outreach to African-American communities to sign up for the Affordable Care Act? Yes?
Yes.
Do we know how well CoverOregon is doing getting people signed up in different communities?
Just kind of relating it back to the criminal justice aspect is that there are actually a lot of folks who are currently incarcerated who are eligible for the CoverOregon, the actual Oregon health plan, upon release. So actually a strategy that we could actually look for forward to is building a kind of an outreach plan within the prisons and within the county jails to actually enroll folks before they get out so that by the time they're out, they actually have health insurance and health coverage so that they can go to regular appointments. So that would be a new strategy that hasn't really developed that I'd recommend. However, there are actual African-American outreach programs, including the Urban League, including the African-American Health Coalition. There's a number of other organizations that are doing intentional outreach to African-American population. Yes.
Thank you.
All right. So some of the criminal justice policy recommendations, we encourage the city to play an active role in the following. Prevent new mandatory minimum sentences, which have a disproportionate impact on African-Americans and other people of color. Evaluate the charging and sentencing practices relating to African-American youth and Measure 11, and make changes to reduce their disproportionate representation in the criminal justice system. Support legislation and programs that enable people to successfully transition from prison to the community. Enact anti-discrimination legislation that prevents employers from dismissing job applicants based solely on an arrest or conviction history, as I spoke of earlier, and expand programs like Project Clean Slate, Better People, SCAFE, ROAR, which helps navigate barriers by providing assistance with driver's licenses, drive training, community service, just being active in your community as a whole. Additional recommendations are to invest in targeted, culturally specific, and responsive programs, services, and models that achieve measurable outcomes for African Americans. High-risk African Americans, offenders specifically, which may be a Class A felony, those people are more likely to commit recidivism because it's harder for them to find a job. Also, resources dedicated for injustice reinvestment through HB House Bill 3194 should help fund these programs and services. And with that, or I'll just stick to the script, determining how African Americans focus and other culturally specific organizations can do best business with the city or partners on city initiatives, access city resources, and be strong advocates for partners of systemically addressing disproportionately and overrepresentation in social service systems, criminal justice, and particularly youth and adult. And name racial profiling as a tool to mark out African-American citizens and to namely label them as threats rather than citizens within the city of Portland. And lastly, I feel, well, quickly, I'll kind of just make a statement. I know we have all in this room, by show of hands or nod or smile or agreement, we've all had a second chance to do something over. Maybe this morning we didn't grab breakfast, or maybe we should have took I-5 North. But if we all had a second chance to do something over, I'm sure everybody in this room would take that opportunity and capitalize on that decision to do something over. So we want to make sure that we are helping men and women achieve success and making sure that we give them a second chance to make a first impression in society, because when they get out, they already have a record. People already look at them like they're a lesser citizen. So we want to make sure that communities are accepting and educated and aware of what's going on and actually putting people back to work, because it can be done. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, comments?
Mr. Price, a couple of things. One, on the issue of anti-discrimination legislation related to arrest and conviction history, I think I saw that the state of Maryland in the past several years has passed something limiting the questions that employers can ask, you know, based on a time cutoff or something. Is there any reason that a local government couldn't do the same thing? And are you aware of any local governments that have passed such anti-discrimination legislation?
A little bit. I am aware of that, more or less. I believe it's in Oregon. I believe they had something called Ban the Box, or maybe it was nationwide. But doing away with that helps. But in addition to that, I think we should couple that with something, because just banning the box is not enough. People are still going to be discriminated from jump, whether they look at the resume and it's not on there, if there's gaps in employment history. So I think it's something that should and can be done in the state of Oregon. And we're always on the cutting edge of doing new and innovative things. Why not, you know, tackle recidivism head on and be a lead state, and other states can model that after us. So yes, I do agree with that, and I think we should put something with that to make sure that it's seen through to its entirety and that people can actually have a successful outcome.
And also, just a comment that I can't resist raising in any discussion of criminal justice. Yeah, I'm sure you're aware of this, but when you talk about prohibiting any more mandatory minimum sentences laws, you get people who say, well, it's because of mandatory minimum sentences laws that we've seen a decline in crime in the last 20 years. And there's a bunch of research that suggests that actually the major reason for the decline in crime has been taking lead out of gasoline, because lead affects parts of the brain that affect impulse control, violence, et cetera. And you saw an increase in crime during a period when we, for the first time, had cars on the road throughout the United States in the 50s and 60s, and then a decrease once they took the lead out of gasoline. So just all those of us who like to see reforms in the criminal justice system, I think that's a piece of ammunition that we should always have with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One comment. Oh, go ahead.
I just also want to underscore your recommendation around clean slate. We have two systems of housing in this country. One is subsidized and regulated. One is market-based. And the market-based system, in some ways, works less effectively than the subsidized housing because of barriers that were built in, like both legal barriers, mm-hmm. but then things like the law that allowed people to turn Section 8 voucher holders away, disproportionately people of color older, or the requirement that you do some kind of background check, and something shows up, and a landlord then has an excuse not to rent to you. So clean slate in helping people take things off their records essentially is also doing yeoman's work in creating ready-to-rent individuals in our community who can rent. And if they don't rent, the greater likelihood of becoming homeless and becoming an enormous, you know, cost center mm-hmm. for our community. The amount of money we spend when someone is on the street and in distress versus the amount of money we can invest in getting a stable outcome is just shocking when you look at
yes.
it. So clean slate, which has many benefits, I think one that is undervalued, is giving people a fair shot at renting mm-hmm. in our community. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons that I think we should continue to fund it. So thank you.
Just another comment I want to add, just sort of to corroborate the good work that you've done in the research here and to help highlight areas where we still need to work. The disproportionate treatment in the criminal justice system starts with the police bureau's treatment of individual citizens and stops, and I've actually directed the police bureau to release our most recent stops compilation data today to really back up the work that you've done here in this report. It shows, of course, that we are not yet equitable in our treatment of people that we're apprehending on the street, whether it's in a casual encounter or a vehicle stop. So the police bureau is going to continue to document what's happening in reality as we work on equity training and other improvements in the culture of the Bureau that make sure that that changes over time. But we are releasing the latest statistics today, and they completely support the rest of your findings. And, of course, if we're treating people inequitably at the front end of the criminal justice system, it shouldn't be too much of a surprise that the back end of the system is producing inequitable results as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mayor Hills and City Council. First of all, may I ask Ann Curry Stevens to come up? I need to get a spot for you.
Thanks, John.
I am the co-chair of the Coalition of Communities of Color. And these recommendations are like overall, and they cover all communities. I'd like to begin by saying I appreciate your remarks when you started, because you talked about some really key things, and the recognition of those things are important for this. For us to have a real conversation about that. And I think the first one is, and I asked Ann to come up because I do have something specific, but if you have data questions about anything that you've heard already, Ann would be the person to ask those questions. So I ask her to come forward. The first one is naming racism. And I believe that 90% of the people that leave home in the morning don't have racist thoughts in their mind. And I believe that because racism is institutionalized, you actually have to do nothing to perpetuate racism. It means just keep on doing what you're doing, business as usual, and you got a racist outcome. So, you know, it's that whole thing in the treatment industry that says that if you keep on doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome, you know, that's the definition of insanity. And we've finally gotten farther enough in our country that it is the definition of insanity. Institutional racism was institutionalized long before anybody in this room was born. So I'm not holding anybody personally responsible, but I am holding everybody responsible for not doing something different. If we don't do something different, and we can go across the board, because what you heard today was the misery index. We went down everything that you can count, that if you're on the wrong end, now racism has two ends. It has a beneficial end where you can be really jolly because you got a benefit from racism that's going on, or you can be the detrimental end. And so this is the fifth report, I believe, that you've heard so far. And the commonality is two things. Everybody you heard a report from is on the wrong end of racism. And the thing that united the communities of color was that was because you had color. And that's what is the common denominator. So we can't delude ourselves anymore. We can't do Portland nice anymore. We can't say it doesn't exist. We have to say, what are we going to change that is going to make those systems that are already, the snowball is already rolling down the hill. So what are we going to do different? I mean, we talk about things like hiring. If I use the same civil service board and use the same kind of interviewing process, do my bureaus still look the same way they've always looked? You know, all of those kind of things, they're in that position for a specific reason, and that reason is it is institutionalized, so it takes no effort to really get there. You know, and I don't read these things, so I have to put my glasses on because I won't go all the way through it. Mr. Hobson said he turned 60. I'm not quite as old as him, but I have to use my glasses. So one of our recommendations is disaggregate the data. You know, it's far too long in our society now. We get data all the time. We're using the best beam counters. We're using machines. And we're collecting all this data. But then we turn around and say, we can't give you specific data on ethnicity and outcomes. Yes, we can. Let's disaggregate the data and put that information out so that we know where we are, so we can measure. We can't say that we're really honestly trying to measure where we are if we're not disaggregating our data and putting it out there. And then, you know, in providing services to communities of color, one of the things that we really have to do is disaggregate the data and publish data of mainstream organizations. There has been a real fallacy out here that mainstream organizations know how to serve communities of color better. And it's just not true. You know, when you start taking people that are being served by organizations of color, those are the highest at-risk people. that go where they are most comfortable and go where they feel confident that they will get the services that they get. Now, do we have enough organizations within communities of color to do it? No, not all of it, but we need to partner together. We need to fund these organizations. And as we're working through the Cradle to Career Collaborative, we have one of the collaboratives is eliminating disparities. All the superintendents of all the school districts in the county are there. We have city representatives there. We have county representatives there. We have the largest funders in terms of private foundations there. And what they have done is they've taken a survey. Do you remember what the name of the survey is? There's an organizational survey that each one of them have taken to see where they line up in terms of where's equity in your organization and where are you. And what I asked Ann to talk about is a protocol that we've been developing through the CARE Institute at Portland State. So I'm going to speak briefly about this and tell you what it actually does.
I'm pleased to share that we're on the verge of publishing a report on the protocol to help mainstream organizations improve the ways they serve communities of color. And so it's a set of assessment metrics and standards that we're asking for mainstream organizations to be held accountable to in terms of the ways that they involve partnerships with communities of color, the kind of metrics, the kind of disclosure around performance standards that are reached, and the kinds of interventions that get used. We increasingly want to make sure that interventions are delivered by culturally responsive service providers developed with the validation of communities of color whose members use these services. And so we're hoping that many leading institutions increasingly say that if you're promising to serve communities of color, we need to hold you accountable to the standards to make sure you do that well. And so that work has been done in partnership with Eliminating Disparities. It's had some early ability to shape some of the Children's Levy call for credentials. And we're hoping that it's a product that increasingly shifts the expectation that rather than communities of color being made to sort of put in a defensive position to say, prove that you're not serving communities well, we really want those that fund mainstream organizations to hold them accountable for the standards with which organizations or communities of color are served.
Yeah, so I wanted to really compliment Dan and the Portland Children's Levy for what they're doing with the RFP, and you're the first ones. And what I'll say is, when we started this thing with the report coming out in, was it 11?
That the 10.
In 10? She got it all. I have to ask her because she'll verify everything. Is that we started out in an adversarial position, and we moved pretty quickly. And Commissioner Fritz, we have the Office of Equity. You know, we still have much work to do, but we moved through some victories, and we're no longer at odds. The whole thing with the Portland's Children's Levy was a partnership and a conversation. And I'm glad that we've moved to that point now so that we're no longer fighting about this and just listening to people talk and listen to the questions that you ask, that we are doing that now, that it's no longer we got to fight for what we got to do. Now it's about doing the right thing. So I have a couple more, and then I'll open up for more questions if you want to ask questions of us or anybody else in the room, then you can. And the other one, the next one is contract with communities of color businesses. The city is a huge economic engine. Millions of dollars are spent for goods and services. And you won't find all this on your PowerPoints that you have. But it's huge. The same with the county and all the school districts. The kind of money that's spent in this city on a daily basis is tremendous amounts of money. I was talking to the school district, and with their levy, that's $500 million that is getting ready to be contracted out. And if communities of color aren't getting any of those dollars that are going into those communities, then we're all losing out as Portlanders, as Oregonians. So we've got to do, again, I said, it's institutionalized. If we don't start doing things differently in the terms of contracting, qualifying people to contract, and helping it get into the business, then we're really going to lose out. And then my final point is, if you say you believe in equity, then it will be reflected in your budget. So when your budgets, and I'll go back to the school district, they were able this time when they released their budget for this year to show us where the equity in the budget was. And I would ask all of you to do the same thing, that you start asking folks, where can I see the equity in the budget? Because you are how you spend your money. And so with that, I'll close, and we'll entertain questions if you have questions for us.
Thank you very much.
And just so you know, the Equity Office did put out an equity tool for each of the budget advisory committees for the different bureaus to use, and it provided some very robust discussion in my bureau. So I agree with that our goals should be reflected in where the money goes. I have a question about disaggregating the data, and particularly with respect to schools. A couple of weeks ago, Portland Public Schools published some data on closing the gap and improving graduation rates. And I'm wondering whether you have the capacity to the one high school in Portland Public Schools that did not close the gap or significantly increase its graduation rate was Madison. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you have the capacity to look at the data of the cohort of kids who started at Marshall High School, which was closed, and to see how they did at either Madison or Franklin and see what the effect was of closing Marshall.
It would certainly be possible to do. The tracking system is now quite robust across the whole state, so it would be fairly easy to pull that data.
I think that would be very helpful for all of us to know when you're talking about budget decisions and political decisions, mm-hmm. to have that to see what those outcomes would be fascinating.
Good point. Other questions?
Yeah, and I have a protocol question. I've got some questions off the report and the discussion we've had that are sort of bigger policy questions. Mm-hmm. And I suspect some of my colleagues do as well. So is there an opportunity to sort of frame those after this hearing and send them to you or to the leadership? Or what would be the most productive way to do that, to frame some follow-up questions and concerns?
So as I understand it, really through coordination with the Coalition of Communities of Color, we'll be coordinating with you as a body in terms of your follow-up questions and then some of the policy recommendations that we brought forth today to continue that conversation and then get to some next steps. Okay.
So communicate through you, Serena, then?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Other questions, comments for this panel as well?
I actually have a request about the issue of putting equity in the budget, which is that, as you know, to a great extent, government budgets tend to be sort of on autopilot. The city has police and fire and parks, mm-hmm. and that's most of our general fund budget. So year to year, we spend most of our money on police and fire and parks. And I think last year we struggled a bit with what reallocations of money might we make between those bureaus and each other or other bureaus or within those bureaus to better reflect your commitment to equity. Mm-hmm. So I ask you to help us do that. And as you see the budget discussion play out in the next few months, make your suggestions as to how we might reallocate resources in order to promote equity. I've made some suggestions as to how we might reallocate some police bureau expenditures towards some other priorities. I'm sure my colleagues will have similar recommendations, but for the most part, we tend to wind up doing what we did last year, and there's reasons for that, but to the extent you can help us change that, that would be useful. Another area is part of the budget that we don't tend to really think about as part of the budget is the investment in the urban renewal areas. And we've got some decisions coming up as to whether to continue those URAs or shut them down early and use the money and thus free up more general fund money for us in the county, or if we are going to continue them, maybe shift the emphasis in how the money is spent. So, again, I'd really appreciate your thoughts as to if we have some monetary flexibility, how should we flex it in a way that best promotes equity goals?
Well, I think that certainly we can be part of that discussion on how that gets done. I think some of those things too are taking a look at those areas where we're seeing some inequities play themselves out, and how can we take those monies and shift them to, if do nothing else, provide better education around the equity lens itself and how that it's being applied so that it doesn't go away but is a resource to provide education and to start doing some things a little bit different than what they've been done before. You know, I was in a discussion, or listened to a discussion, and they talked about how the crime rate has dropped 51% since 1999. And the real reason that it has dropped since 1999, there's been less arrests. It's not that we have after-the-fact programs that have done things to keep people from reoffending. We've, in the front end, have had less arrests. So I would ask you, at what point, when the crime rate has dropped 51% since 1999, then at what point can we start reallocating some of those dollars to do some more front-end preventative kinds of things versus we're always going to pay for law and order at this high level when all the data says, and we don't really have to. Some of those things will just be reassessing what we're doing and taking a different look at how we do it.
Steve, I saw your face light up a little bit.
Well, you thought I was going to say get more unleaded?
No, but let's remember that point you just made, sir, and come back to it in a couple weeks, and it will become clear the context for having that conversation.
Other questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we need a motion to accept this report.
So moved.
Second.
Any further discussion? Then let's take a council roll call on that, please, Sue.
This series of reports has the subtitle, An Unsettling Report. And indeed, it was so unsettling to me when I heard the first Coalition of Color report, along with the State of Black Oregon report, showing that disparities are worse than they were 17 years ago, that I embarked on the discussion of what are we going to do about it within the City of Portland? What am I going to do about it within the City of Portland? And so we established the Office of Equity. The disturbing evidence in these reports shows that we're not, the outcomes aren't there, and we can do all the training. We do need to do all the training so that people understand what their responsibilities are. We also need to have actions that promote outcomes, and I very much appreciate your specific recommendations. I'll be looking through those. But anybody who values equity and inclusion and justice cannot sit and turn their back on this. As you said, it perpetuates institutional racism to do nothing. And it was the main reason that I ran for a second term, that I invested my family's life savings, was because I knew that we were not going to be done with equity work after just 2 years of the Office of Equity and Human Rights. And I don't think we're going to be done with it after my second term either. But by the time you're giving the report in 2016, I hope that we can say, look at what the changes and look at the outcomes and look at what we've done that has created differences. And we did hear that from Ms. Thorne Ladd in terms of the Future Connect program and restorative justice and some of the efforts that we've made over the last 5 years to invest in children. And I do think that the improved graduation rate shows that we're starting to have those outcomes, but we need to start at pre-K, never mind, or at birth, preconception, teaching families to get their health care all along. And thank goodness we now have Obamacare so that people, everybody has access to health care. That will make a huge difference. So we need to do the training, and Mayor, we need to make sure that every city employee has received at least baseline training so that all of us are thinking about these questions. And we need to fund the positions within the bureaus that dig deep. It's not the Office of Equity's job to be doing many of the things that you outline as action items. It's housing, it's parks, it's police, it's the bureaus that need to do the work. And what I'm finding now that I'm looking at implementation in a larger bureau is you need people at the helm who are committed. You need elected officials who are setting the standard and the expectation, who are asking in performance reviews, how are we doing with hiring? What are the numbers? What is your goal? Of course, we can't set quotas, but we can have goals, and we can ask those questions, and just asking the question sets the expectation, better do something about that. And so I certainly appreciate this data. It gives exactly what you were hoping with the Coalition of Communities of Color, that by you can't ignore this data. You can choose not to do anything about it. I could not choose not to do anything about it. And I'm committing to you right now that I agree with you that the resources need to be there. And the Office of Equity has a small request in the budget for an administrative assistant, which normally wouldn't rise to the level of, oh gosh, that's my number one priority. It's a huge priority to have the people who are going to set up the meetings, to set up the programs, to make sure that we're collecting that data within our system as well and making sure that we're tracking. So this is very timely that you came in to talk with us, and thanks to the wider community putting your ongoing passion into this. And I will keep working with you as long as I have the privilege to be in this position. Aye.
Fish.
I want to thank everyone that's come before us today and testified so passionately, and thank you for the work that you and Lisa, Dr. Bates did in preparing the report. You know, we've been talking a lot as a council about challenges in East Portland. And I think recently there's a sense has developed on this body that we need a small and Marshall plan for East Portland, that we can't just keep doing one-offs and staying behind the curve, that we have to be intentional. What does intentional look like for East Portland? It means taking two failed urban renewal districts and finding a way to resuscitate them. It means immediate, in my view, investments in safety, so streets and sidewalks. It means the history-making announcement that Commissioner Fritz made the other day about 20 acres of new parks in East Portland, funded through SDCs, and then a commitment to maintain them. It means a whole cluster of actions, supporting funding with the David Douglas Early Learning Center, which we did through an urban renewal district. It means Zanger Farm and helping to promote hunger relief programs. But it means a whole cluster of intentional actions with the goal of making measurable differences. So what I've learned on this council is when we focus on outcomes and specific tangible things that we can do, we're pretty good at meeting that challenge. When it's at an abstract level, we don't do so well. So I think Cully Concordia plan focuses on action items. East Portland Action Plan focuses on action items. What I like about this report and what I like about some conversations I've had with leadership, and I guess the most recent one was with Serena, was when we were able to get past diagnosing the problem to what does a win look like and what specifically does a win look like. Now, you say you want to see equity in our budgets. Well, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure what equity looks like in our budget. So that's a question we're going to have to grapple with, because I think we could spin equity a lot of different ways in our budgets. But what is equity as you are challenging us today look like in our budget? Is it maintaining the status quo, or is it doing something different, or is it reallocating the pies? So we do our best work when we have specific things that we're asked to do. And I think the conversation that PALF has sponsored coming out of the MLK discussion, this report and the testimony before us today, and then the specific action items is enormously helpful to us, because I believe we do best when there's a tangible goal to shoot for, to seek. Now, because there are so many, and they apply to so many jurisdictions, I think the next thing we ought to do is prioritize what round one looks like. What does a win look like in this budget cycle? What are some tangible things we can do, knowing we've got a little extra money to spend, knowing that there's a lot of attention now in certain parts of our city, and we're asking questions about what does economic development look like? How should we spend our housing resources? So maybe we can get to a short list of some wins. And then perhaps we can institutionalize that, so every year we're asking the same question. East Portland, we're asking what cluster of things can we do to impact the lives of where 40% of our families with children live, and poverty is increasingly being centralized. Inner East, interstate, with all the tools we have in our kit, what can we do this budget cycle and next budget, and very tangibly. You know the old adage that one of my colleagues once told me, that when you send an email to all five of us, you usually don't get a response. That has to be modified now, because Commissioner Fritz responds on behalf of all of us. But the reality is, if you want something done, you send an email to one commissioner, and you say, will you be my champion? That's just the nature of our form of government. So I appreciate the focus on specific action items, and I think our challenge is now to prioritize those action items and to really think about this budget cycle and the next budget cycle, because there's nothing like momentum. Nothing is more powerful than having a series of wins that we can come back and say, hey, we did something. And the narrative is now, let's build on success, not the other. So I really appreciate the report and the conversation, and we have a lot of work to do, but I think this is a promising start. So thank you. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, thank you for your report. I do appreciate the positive feedback about how the children's levy, primarily the staff, have worked hard to incorporate a lot of recommendations from the Coalition of the Community of Color and putting together their request for investments as we set the table to invest another $10 million a year in programs that help children be successful. So I appreciate that feedback, and I really don't deserve it. It's the staff that deserve the credit for that, although the Allocation Committee, I think, certainly set the tone. And I think that just picking up what Commissioner Fish said, there's a lot in here, a lot of recommendations. It can be overwhelming, so I think we do have to sort of carve out what's going to be a year one set of accomplishments, even though we're not in year one, but, you know, we're certainly looking at year one going forward with this budget. And I do think, you know, probably for me the most vexing issue will be is, and I think it's been characterized well here, is equity in the budget really simply each bureau creating a new position for an equity coordinator? I don't think that's necessarily what you're thinking of. Now, it may provide, you know, a certain panacea, but it also deflects sort of the ultimate focus from a bureau director for responsibility for what happens mm-hmm. in his or her bureau. And it also takes time, because if we create those positions in each bureau, then it's going to be a couple years before those positions are filled, and therein lays yet another reason why progress can't be made in year one, because we're still getting our equity apparatus up and running. So that's something I will be, you know, taking a look at, wrestling with, because I know many bureaus are asking for exactly that, you know, give us a position to focus on equity. And, just as we had a rather robust debate on a similar thread around the creation of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, I think it's important that we look at this issue as we decide. And there always is an opportunity cost if you're investing in positions and taking time to create those positions and sort of postponing the day of reckoning, then there's other things in the short term that aren't getting done that probably could be done that might be in your report that are more specific, tangible, dollar-related recommendations. So, you know, I will take your report to heart. I appreciate all the recommendations, and I'm sure we'll have a robust debate about this in the days to come. So thank you very much. Aye.
Novit.
Thank you so much. Very much appreciate all the work that went into the report, the information in it, the recommendations in it. Just wanted to share another thing that I agonize over, which is the potential gentrification effect of transportation investments. We were talking about the Barber Concept Plan a number of months ago. Commissioner Fish was asking, how do we be sure that we don't promote sort of transportation-oriented gentrification, where only rich people live near the station stops? And that's something that it's really hard to figure out in a state where the legislature has prohibited us from adopting inclusionary zoning. And I know that we'll continue to work to try to reverse that preemption. That Andrea Valderrama and my staff, who focus in East Portland, periodically reminds me that even when we talk about making what seem like simple, obvious investments in transportation, safety and livability, sidewalks, maybe paving some streets, she will encounter people who ask the question, what will that mean in terms of, I mean, does that raise the prospect that my rent will, I mean, I'd like to have the sidewalks, maybe my rent will go up and I'll have to move. And I think that addressing the, you know, being able to use inclusionary zoning would certainly help. But, and I mean, like Commissioner Fish, my reaction is I still would like to see flashing beacons at dangerous intersections. I'm not going to not do it and not put in sidewalks entirely because I'm concerned about gentrification, but it is a concern. And that's something that I really appreciate, you know, your ongoing help in figuring out how we balance, you know, the obvious need for certain investments with the concern about, will the people we're making those investments for be forced to move?
Hales.
Oh, hi, sorry.
So what I like about city government is that it has a relentless drive towards practical things. And you've given us both a clear and compelling indictment of what's not just and right in our city, and also very clear guidance for what we can do that will make a difference. And I like that, and I want that dialogue to continue, not just in the budget, but in everything that we do. I have kind of a simple approach to some of these things, which is find something that works, make sure that it's working, and then do it again and again and again. So if we have programs like SEI or Sun Schools that are making a difference for kids, then let's find a way to do more of that, take it to scale. Last week we had, for the first time in a while, we hired some more police officers because, as you know, although we went through a bad budget time and we had to lay people off in city government, fortunately not in the police bureau, but then we had to wait a while to hire more police officers. Well, we hired the most diverse class of police officers ever last week, and that's good, but now we need to do that again and again and again and again. So let's find those things that work and replicate them in the programs and functions of city government. Find those partnerships that work. Every 2 weeks I go to the youth gang task force meeting that that we bring the whole community together that affects our young people. And we had a couple young men at the last meeting who were coming out of the criminal justice system into a job with a network of people around them that support them. That works. You can see it in their eyes. You can hear it in the pride that they have in coming back into the community in a positive way. And let's find ways to replicate those successes. So, again, I think the value of this to me as a leader is that it is both a comprehensive indictment of what's not right and a specific set of instructions about how to make it better. And to me, that, and to all of us, I think you hear in our comments here, we're all looking now for ways and means to make this real in what the city does and how we hire people, how we spend money, how we develop the community, how we do business. And please continue to bring us facts and information. Please continue to bring us ideas and hold us accountable to making the improvements that this report literally cries out for. Thank you so much. Aye.
Can we take a four-minute break?
We can do better than that because we've been told that our final item can be delayed. So if the council is willing to adhere now,
I object.
We will hold item 174 to next week, and we are adjourned.
I've been waiting all week for
yeah. Yes. Raise your hand.
Raise your
hand. Raise your hand. Call you.
What do we get the peace dividend? Thank you.